You're listening to Soap Sound Radio. We bring you streaming and live broadcasting from the capital. This is the El Arpa Podcast. So, Maria, did you enjoy your butter biscuit?
Yes.
You did. Okay, you're still half digesting that, but welcome to the latest episode of the El Arpa Podcast, and I would like to thank everybody who listened to our last episode. It's had a phenomenal response on Twitter and also in the stats of the listens as well. So thank you very much for that. That was a very nice episode to do, and today we're going to be talking about food, glorious food. And we're going to be taking stops at Egypt, Malawi, Ireland, Syria. So all these culinary hotspots. And we'll be talking about that in more detail. But Mary?
Yes?
Yes? Okay, so you... I'll be honest. I've fallen off the Irish wagon a little bit this week. But I'm going to get back into it today with you after this podcast recording. But you came across a truly magical artistic module in the Irish course that was very elevating for the soul. I would have it to be believed. I'm not sure how that expression goes. So maybe you can take over and explain.
Well, we're on week three, which is, well, there's another week left.
Sorry, I was just indicating you should speak louder.
We're on week three. Yep. I can't speak any louder than this. And there's a section that is quite interesting that is on cinema, on Irish cinema. And then there is another section talking basically about directions, but also about the weather. So it tells you how to give directions to somebody, then it tells you the cardinal points, and then it tells you basically, different names for like types of wind and things like that.
Okay.
And it's very interesting because it just shows you how things like the weather are very important in like the Irish psyche. And it reflects in expressions that Irish people don't even know nowadays that they come from that or know the expression at all.
Yes. Like me today.
Like you today.
I hope passive-aggressiveness transmits well on podcasts. But the expression you did explain to me today, what is it in Irish and what is the English translation? Okay, tell us what the English translation is. I'm going to grab my phone.
I've got it here.
Okay, you have it here as well.
Yes, but...
I mean, it comes from the northwest, so something that is surprising, no?
Yes.
For example, so you have what you've written down here is a near... A duoc.
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. And it means it's from the northwest, which is to say, surprised you. Mm-hmm. That is a very beautiful expression. Was there more to that expression that they explain in the course?
Yes, that they basically say that the orientation is related to the sun.
Okay.
So this is the normal way.
The sun in the sky or the sun in the Holy Ghost?
No. This
Wait a minute. Okay, we're going to pause it just for a moment while we do our research. Okay, so the phrase means it's something that surprises you, and you're going to explain how we get our sense of the direction is heavily influenced by how you face the sun. So if you're facing the sun in a certain way, maybe you can take it from here.
Yeah, it's influenced by the rising of the sun. So then if you're facing the rising sun to the east, then south is on your right hand side. So that's why the phrase to the right comes from the word for south, and the one to the left comes from another word for north.
Okay, so you mean the word for right in Irish, so turn to the right, that word we say is derived from that elements,
yeah,
related
on the
to
right,
the sun.
Yeah, on
okay.
The right and on the left.
Yeah.
And also that's what influences the sentence that we, or the phrase that we were talking about, because that means from the northwest.
Okay.
So from the northwest is by surprise, because if you are facing the rising sun to the east, then northwest is behind you.
Okay, great. Okay, so what else do you want to say about this part? Or is there anything else before we move on to the next item in part one?
Well, that another very interesting thing is about the wind. And then it talks about different types of wind. And there's even a poem that tells you what each type of wind does, because that's very important for Irish people. And I think you can tell me that, but I believe it's very windy in certain parts of the coast.
Yeah, it is. It's incredibly windy.
In the Atlantic coast.
Well, no, because of our unique geographic conditions. We, of course, are exposed to the North Atlantic Drift, which is a very particular current stream. That's why we get exposed to wilder, wetter weather than the rest of Europe. We are the bulwark, essentially, against the elements. And by the time that weather system, when it's coming from that direction, reaches the United Kingdom and into to Europe, the mainland of Europe, it's lost a lot of its power. So that's, why we have very specific conditions that really explain our terrible weather. But on a sunny day,
I thought you were going to say a terrible mood.
Well, there's a guy I know who used to live in Madrid, and he came to Madrid last year when Ireland was actually in the middle of a heat wave. Now, there's nothing that Irish people dislike more is when there's good weather when they're on holiday. Because what's the point of going on holiday? essentially. But he was like saying that like Irish people are never happy because it's always raining and then the sun is shining and then after 2 days it's like, it's roasting, it's too hot. Will the rain come back, you know? But in our terrible moods, what, in general?
No, I was just winding you up because
of
this like idea that Irish people are a bit depressed sometimes, you know?
Oh, no.
This literary idea.
That's because of famine, immigration and colonization. So easy.
I thought I would give you the opportunity to say. Okay, but you want to hear what the different winds do?
Yes, please. Yeah.
Okay, so the north wind.
Just are you impressed? I haven't laughed or sniggered at wind.
Very.
Yeah, because we're also doing an audiobook, and I'll explain a little bit more about that in part three, probably.
Yes, definitely.
But I was corpsing at very juvenile things. So
yes.
It's been a victory so far.
It was until you mentioned it.
Okay, so fill us in on the different types of wind that we have in Ireland.
Okay, so it says the north wind is hard and she depresses the people.
Okay.
This is a literal translation.
Yeah.
The south wind is damp and she makes sheets grow.
Okay.
The east wind is dry and she brings hail at night.
Okay.
And the west wind is generous and she puts fish in nets.
Okay, there it is. Fish nets, I laugh. Okay.
Fish in nets. Okay. Not fish nets.
Sorry.
And the weather happens, sorry, the wind happens to be feminine in Irish.
Okay, well, it's interesting because there's a correlation with Madrid, isn't there? Because there's a wind that happens in January that's quite notorious for going right through your bones, isn't there?
In Madrid?
In Madrid.
Well, that would be it's called the Cierzo.
Yeah, Cierzo, that's the one. Yes. Yeah, I've heard that colloquially.
I mean, it's not really that it reaches Madrid as such, it's just that when, because it's a very cold, dry wind, when it's cold and dry here in the winter, then people refer to the wind as Cierzo.
Okay, so they're exaggerating, but
yeah.
Madrid does get very cold in January, and I think a lot of people here, whether it's true or not, do relate that to this wind.
Maybe, because they're just not northerners.
yeah, tough northerners like you. That was a part one full of hot air, unless you've more things to say about that. No, you don't. Okay, so we will move on to in a southwesterly direction into part two, and we'll be joining you then. Okay, so welcome back to part two of the show. We're going to be talking about food, glorious food. And what better place to start than with J.R.R. Tolkien, a hymn of Lord of the Rings fame and The Hobbit. If more of us valued food and cheer and song above hoarded gold, it would be a merrier world. Okay. And it's kind of ironic. We're just doing a podcast, and apparently a podcast company have started following us on Twitter, by the way, because I was reading that quote from my phone. Congratulations to us. So, food is a centerpiece of part two of the show. And the reason we're talking about food is because, well, there's this thing called direct provision in Ireland as related to refugees and their status in the country. It is something that involves at, well, nominally a temporary solution, but for people who've been there for years and could potentially be there for a longer period of time as well. Apparently, well, not apparently, but statistically, 200 people come into the country as refugees into Ireland every day. And they are put up in hotels and they're fed by catering companies. Now, this is problematic because you have to share the hotel room either with your family or three other people. And also, you can't cook. Well, you don't have the facilities, but I think also you are forbidden from cooking. And you don't really have a choice. You know, the catering company have the menu. They give you this thing every day. Well, I mean, it differs every day, but it's not as if you have option A, B, or C. And this lack of choice, this lack of kind of autonomy is something that obviously plays havoc with a lot of people's mental health, and it's not very dignified or doesn't give a lot of dignity to these people who are refugees, and it's not really upholding their human rights. In a lot of centres as well, people are obligated to come back at a certain time as well. So maybe the curfew could be like 10 or 10:30. So it's a very rigid, very controlled existence. And according to a lot of commentators, it's setting people up for failure, because once it's like being in prison. You know, you're not socializing properly, or you're not participating in society in a traditional or normal way. And then when you are released into society, then you fail, because you're just not exposed to people in the normal way for a large period of your life. And even for kids who've come into this, have grown up perhaps, or are growing up with this lack of choice, and it must be doing a lot of damage to them, you know, because they're not having normal childhoods. Now, you know, even like practical matters, there's a woman who was interviewed recently about this. She is in one of these hotels. And she was talking about how one day she was sick. And when you're sick, of course, you want to have maybe dry toast or soup. But all they do is low-cost fried food. And you don't really have the option of having that soup or that dry toast because, well, you don't have any autonomy. So those things we take for granted that we can do in our own homes is denied to a lot of people. There's also other factors. It's not really discussed by politicians. There'll be elections coming up soon in the country, and you know, if you ask your representative in the Irish Parliament, the Dáil, probably they won't have a lot of answers, because it's not something that's a burning issue in the public discourse, even though people are becoming more aware of it and are feeling, well, it's not really proper or right that this is happening. People are comparing it to the modern day Magdalene laundries. And people say it's like the next, in terms of the fact that it's the next human rights scandal that's kind of happening and will erupt at some point in the country. Incidentally, also speaking of the Magdalene laundries, the game Mousetrap, have you ever played that?
I don't think so.
Well, that was made in the 90s in Magdalene laundries for free, and then sold for a massive profit, of course, around the world, which is a kind of incredible incidental fact. And one of the women who was interviewed, she's actually standing. She's the first refugee to stand on a docket for a party, the Social Democrats. And she's going to obviously bring this into the public discourse by virtue of the fact that she's a refugee. She's the only one standing for election. It's going to be very visible, this issue. So maybe there will be movement on that in the future. They've also discussed how the situation has happened. A lot of hotels were built during the economic boom of the Celtic Tiger. Once the economy collapsed, a lot of these hotels were failing, and this was a way to get people into those hotels. And then you can give contracts to catering companies to feed these people for a low cost, high profit margin. And of course, going back to the point about them not being able to cook for themselves, that's obviously as well in the interest of these catering companies, because, well, if they want to cook for themselves, they have to get their food from one source. So there's a lot of like those elements to it as well. So that's kind of the scene of what's happening in Ireland at the moment. But a lot of kind of interesting, wonderful people have come together from different countries, from Syria, from Malawi, from African countries. And what they do is they exchange recipes and bake and cook together. And the social life kind of springs from that, to hear them being interviewed, because they do it in collaboration with an Irish foodie blogger. And they were saying, well, it just goes to show, like, a lot of these centres where people are staying as refugees don't have a lot of resources. But it only takes one person going in and organising it, or a couple of people, and this is what's happened here. And their enthusiasm is infectious. I think once a month they kind of have this whole food fair, and they ask the people, okay, what two countries are we going to cook for, or cook? And then someone could say Syria, another person could say Eritrea. And then they're like, okay, well, we're going to make Eritrean and Syrian dishes. And then people from the town can come and they can sample it and learn about the countries where these people come from. And, just be exposed on so many levels to another culture, to the story of being a refugee, and also to just on a kind of maybe more basic level, or perhaps not, a gastronomic exposure, which is, to experience like Eritrean food. What do Eritreans do with potatoes that Irish people don't? These kind of things. It's really successful. They have so many people involved in it. So many people who are interested in it. And also, according to the Irish food blogger, from her perspective, sitting around a table, having a conversation with your family, it's not just about the food, even though the food is very important, because you can choose to cook it, you decide to cook it, you're involved in cooking it, but also it's very deeply connected to a culture that they've left behind. And even with this story, it's quite fascinating, because the Malawian woman who was interviewed on this podcast, the Blind Boys podcast, is where I got some of the information for this, including other sources. She talks about how, she came from a good family, a rich family, and she didn't want for anything when she was growing up. But then her uncle and some other men in her family were murdered for their political ideas. And she's saying, well, it's not, it could happen to anybody, because she grew up in relative privilege. And then that happened to her. And then she's come over to Ireland, and, she speaks very positively about how integration can happen. And one step through that is true food as well, because we all share food, we all eat food, and food is fundamentally for sharing. Which, Mary, I'll bring you in at this point, because I remember going way back when, maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago, we discussed this idea as well, the food and the communal aspect in culture. Do you remember that conversation?
Yes, I remember, because I think it started with the word for partner or colleague in Spanish, which is compañero, that comes from Latin, but it's basically, is to say, with bread. So it's like, it talks about somebody that you would share your bread with. So it's just a nice word to refer to a colleague or a partner or a friend, you know?
Okay.
And also, a comrade. That's the word the translation.
Well, we have from the Bible as well, I think, to break bread with somebody, is a very performative act. It's a very theatrical, symbolic act of breaking bread with another person.
Yes. And in Spanish, you have making breadcrumbs. To say, good breadcrumbs is like you get on well.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Like two peas in a pod.
Yes.
You two breadcrumbs on a table.
No, but you just say that you make good breadcrumbs. Well, I think it's because there's a dish that is breadcrumbs.
Okay.
With chorizo.
Yeah, I've seen that, yeah.
Migas.
Yeah. Yeah, not as nice as it looks.
I don't like it at all. It's very dry, but the expression is nice.
It is a very nice expression. Do you like peas?
I do, actually.
Yeah, me too.
With ham.
Yeah, excellent. Good choice there. Of course, as well, food is obviously a fundamental part of any culture. Saying last week St. Patrick's Day, I guess people would assume that it's bacon and cabbage and corned beef, maybe. What's interesting about St. Patrick's Day is that it is, in a way, a celebration where the world can see what other people who aren't Irish think being Irish is,
Yeah.
Because I can't imagine a gay pride parade being full of straight people putting on a show imagining what a gay lifestyle is like if that makes sense.
But yeah, like, yeah, it's quite an event. It's yeah, quite peculiar.
Yeah, but we accept St. Patrick's Day as being something that's authentically Irish when in many ways it's not. And even the fact that the food that is a typical food seen by a lot of people that is seen as, you know, but it's not really the typical food. Oh, okay. So it's just even, you know, through the prism of gastronomy, you can see that disconnect between the reality and what it has been packaged as now, you know, something very commercial and devoid of any meaning.
Apart from on our blog.
Well, of course,
because
we
had great celebrations of St. Patrick's.
We did, actually got a lot of views on that as well, so that was amazing. Always nice to be part of that. So, so yeah, but you obviously have a deep knowledge of Egypt, and that also extends to the food. So what cultural insights can you offer us?
Well, the food staples were bread and beer. And
okay.
You know, the basics of the diet.
Sounds good to me.
Yes, I. This is what I would say, also the basics of the diet now. So basically what you could cook with the grain that you had available. So it's the easiest thing to do. But well, there are plenty of scenes of offerings, food offerings, because in Egypt, well, the ancient Egyptians believed that you had to be fed in the other life. So once the person was dead, the family would take food offerings. Well, constantly, and that is how we have remains of a lot of food. So, for example, in the archaeology museum here in Madrid, we have bread that is about 3,000 years old.
Okay.
So it's quite impressive, and also lots of seeds. So, for example, fruit seeds, right?
Okay.
In the excavation, for example, like you can come across vine seeds, for example, like grapes, little grapes, or like dates also are quite common.
Yeah.
So all those things were used and got preserved. They were stored in jars. But also in the reliefs, a lot of different food, not just, well, drink and food, like beef, you know, big legs of meat, duck, plenty of things are offered on the off chance that people forget to make the actual physical offerings. So that's to say, if your family couldn't bring you the food or forgot to bring you the food, then the food that was portrayed on the walls could magically come to life and feed you.
Okay. So it's kind of a very intriguing prospect that the food is represented even if you don't have it. That it's like filling the gap of the reality as well. It's plentiful, if only in imagination as well.
That's quite common for Egypt. Like everything that you lack kind of like magically can come to being through representation. It also happens, for example, with amulets, and where you basically hang around your neck the things that you expect that you might need in the afterlife.
I wonder if the story of Jesus and the loaves and the fishes, I mean, because he's not in Egypt, but he's in the area, you know, he's in the neighborhood. So, like, I mean, maybe, well, I know you're not a Catholic theologian, but I wonder if it's like that story is also kind of based on that kind of concept that would have spread around that area as well.
Now that you mention it, there's a very interesting connection with regard to like fish and the idea of like fish being this stuff that I talk about in the museum. Because basically there was a type of fish in ancient Egypt that incubated the eggs in its mouth.
Okay.
And basically when they were ready to be born, they just came out of the mouth. So all Egyptians saw were like little fish coming out of a big fish. But then, for example, when they were in danger, they would go back and seek refuge in the mother's mouth.
Okay.
So all they saw was basically that she gave life through the mouth, and also she basically ate her children, and then they came back to life. So, you know, there's a very interesting connection in the fact that later on, obviously, the Copts, that are the first Christians in Egypt, start using the symbol of the fish to refer to Christ and resurrection and coming to life. So.
In Irish culture, I think we touched on this in the podcast as well. Oh, no, we didn't, actually. Well, I showed you a video. The Salmon of Knowledge.
Oh, yeah.
And the Shroud of Dochrach.
Yeah.
Well, we won't focus on the second one, but... well, in this story, this is a fish that's, if you catch it and eat it, you're given the gift of great knowledge. And elsewhere in Ireland, if you kiss a stone that centuries of people have peed on, you have to get the gift of conversation, which ironically left me there momentarily. In Egyptian culture, fish, do they have this other dimension as well in terms of like giving like a gift of some human characteristic that...
Well, I think the gift of life is quite a big one already.
apart from that.
apart from life and death,
yeah,
you know.
Apart from that minor one. No, and you've been to Egypt as well in the modern times. So in terms of communal eating and traditions, like for example, like I heard in the Blind Boy podcast, like in Africa, in Malawi, I should say, that it's very... structured, that I guess like it is in a lot of cultures, but when it comes to a wedding, you eat this certain food. When it comes to a funeral, it's this certain food, which, you know, of course we all have that to an extent, but it seems from what I heard to be very codified there. I don't know in Egypt if something is similar there, if they have certain traditions around the food, or if they eat in a certain way, or they eat together and it has this kind of symbolism, this meaning behind it as well.
Yes, definitely, I would say so. I mean, I think in terms of celebrations, you basically give the best you can, you know, each family gives the best that they can offer. So more than assets, food is like just plenty of food and of the best quality that you can offer everybody. And everybody's invited, of course. And in terms of like ordinary eating, yes, you normally sit, well, I've sat plenty of times like on the floor, and then it's very common to have, I don't know, just like I'm talking traditionally, for example, in the villages,
yeah,
to have a dish of rice, and then people just get the rice from the same plate, you know, you just help yourself from there, sometimes even with the hands, for example. Fish, as a matter of fact, when I was, the times I was eating there with a family in a village, you ate it with the hands, and it's quite interesting when you're presented with a full fish that has just, you know, been taken out of the river a few hours later, and you have no knife and fork, and you just have to do it all with your hands.
Okay.
No napkins, of course. Or like...
not even cocktail forks.
No, or like freshening towels and stuff like that. So it's actually quite a challenge, but well.
And then your inner cat qualities came out.
I mean, I was more worried about not dying from the fact that they just got that out of one of the Nile canals, which are not particularly famous for being, you know, squeaky clean. So
I guess it's better in the Ganges or something.
50-50, I would say.
Well, speaking of food and refugees, I know a guy in the Netherlands who has set up an NGO there, and they also give food to refugees. Now, it's different because in this context, in the Irish context, it's very empowering and directed by, well, the perfect combination of the Irish and the new Irish, the refugees and the people who are local there. And that's obviously a very positive thing. In the Netherlands, it's a little bit different. It's the Dutch people who are cooking and preparing the food, and they invite the refugees to eat that food, which, of course, is also very good because it's in the spirit of collaboration and, you know, socializing and integration, ultimately. Now, they also have a second dimension in this NGO, which is to reuse, well, not reuse food, but to use food that would otherwise be thrown out by supermarkets. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to add that this is obviously very safe food, it's good food, and we just have a societal conception of like food that's good or bad, that's not really related to the actual condition of the food. What's interesting is that sometimes when refugees figure this out, well, or find this out, I should say, they get a bit offended as if they're being given second-class food or lower-quality food. And then the guy I know has to explain, no, no, we have a double mission here, which is to integrate and collaborate with refugees, but also to stop food waste, and this food is actually very good as well. Mm-hmm. So in terms of cultural challenges, in the Irish Initiative, I haven't come across any yet, but I think, apart from the institutional problem of the accommodation, which is obviously blocking people from having an integrated and full adaptation into Irish culture and life, which is problematic in the extreme. But in terms of the food, how it's prepared and how people interact across that, it seems to be, well, excuse the pun, all gravy. And it's going very well. Are you familiar with that expression?
No.
Okay, it means everything's going well.
I got it.
Again, well, you're a good student. You can guess the idiom from the context of the sentence, which is what we always advise our students to do. Anyway, so what we'll do is we'll take a quick look at food culture around the world before we go into part three. Okay, so first port of call is Japan.
Okay.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Arigato. So at New Year's, they have a year crossing noodle. That's kind of literal translation. And they eat it because it means, well, it's supposed to bring prosperity and peace and good tidings for the new year. Of course, in Israel, they have latkes, which are potatoes, basically. I've had those for Sinterklaas, which is Dutch Christmas. I've had them because it was a joint celebration of Hanukkah as well, which is a Jewish element of it. And this foodstuff celebrates the biblical miracle of one day's worth of oil lasting 8 whole nights. And they're usually served with a sweet sauce like apple, and quite delicious. Can't go wrong if you're Irish and there's a potato involved. For example, one really great one I've tried before is a great Romanian restaurant near where I live, and they have something called sarmale. Have you ever had that before?
I don't think so.
Well, it dates all the way back to the Ottoman Empire. So the flavors have been mastered over centuries. It's basically cabbage rolls stuffed with beef and pork and these things. And during great festivities, it's a typical dish there, I'm led to believe. And it's very, very nice. They eat fish in Germany for sometimes. But what I want to talk about before I go into that, for example, one thing I've also tried before with you in an Ethiopian restaurant is the ebeg wat, which is a Christmas dish. It's like a buttery and hearty lamb stew, and it comes with flatbread and everything as well. You kind of dip off the flatbread and then just tuck into it, and it's really, really nice. That's kind of a Christmas dish, but I've had it before out of season in an Ethiopian restaurant, and it
with
is
me.
With you, yeah. And you really enjoyed it, I remember.
Do you imagine really well?
I think that's it for food. I'm starving ravens at this point. So what we'll do is we'll go to part three, and we'll talk to you then. Thank you. Welcome back to part three of the show. So we mentioned an audiobook in part one. We have done a lot of work on it now. I think it's going to come out, well, I'm not sure when it's going to come out, but we're going to be finished it over the next week or so, I think. We've designed the logo, the name, the poetry inside, obviously, because otherwise we'd be plagiarizing. And as we mentioned last week, there's been a lot of interest on Twitter. I think there's been buzz that's been generated by you, our social media master. So how have you found the process of recording your poems and perfecting the intonation and transmitting the messages through lilting in your voice and all that, you know?
Okay, it's kind of strange because somehow I think when you're reading your own poems, you read them in a certain way in your head. And then sometimes it's not as easy when you are reading them out loud to read them in the same way as you read them in your head, if that makes any sense.
Exactly, yeah.
I know it sounds a bit strange, but...
Well, it's also different from a podcast where it's natural and here you're trying to put emphasis on certain points.
Yes, it's true. But also I think when you are reading a poem and you can see the lines, you know, just there on the paper, sometimes or very often, for example, I use a line that refers to the one before and the one after. So it can be read as the second line of the same sentence from above, or as the first line of the next one. And that's something that you lose when you're reading, because you have to choose which one you're going to go for.
Okay, so that's quite interesting. We have more recording to do after this podcast, so we will move on with that as well. But one thing that you have become an expert in is flogging a certain republic. Radio Republic.
Radio Public.
Sorry, I always make that mistake. It's not rehearsed, it just happens.
No, it's because the audiobook platform is called Authors Republic.
Ah, yes, okay.
Yes, but no, they're two different things.
And I'm from the Republic of Ireland.
Exactly.
And also I studied in the People's Republic of Cork.
Nah, okay.
Yeah. And I once knew a guy from the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia.
And we're generally Republican. Okay.
Yeah.
Radio Public.
Yes.
So, well, you can listen to us on basically all the main podcast platforms. But if you listen to us on Radio Public, you support us because we get a tiny bit of revenue every time somebody listens through that platform.
Exactly. So do that. You can also find us on El Arpa. Our blog on Irish Slice of Madrid. We are also on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook now as well. We've launched a business page, Patreon, LinkedIn, and a few other platforms as well, so you can follow us there. And that's it for another week. So have a great weekend, have a wonderful week, and actually hashtag not a soccer football podcast but Liverpool are top of the table, and hopefully the boys in green get a victory this weekend, and Liverpool are also in the Champions League quarter final against Porto. Life is good. So hashtag not a football podcast.
Okay. So
thank you very much for tuning in and listening. We will talk to you again very soon. Ciao. The El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.